Welcome to the 180 Degrees podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan, your host. And over the next 12 episodes, I'll be talking to experts in the industry about Ireland's energy revolution, how we can all become smarter energy users, renewable technologies, and how businesses can benefit from decarbonising now. Transport in Ireland, a conversation for the ages. It's not just about cars anymore. It's really about imagining how we utilise all forms of transport, from trams to trains and even bicycles on our roads. To reshape our transportation landscape, reduce emissions and tackle traffic problems, we need reliable and accessible public transport options. In this episode, I'm delighted to be joined again by Fergus Sharkey, Head of Business Ports and Transports at the SEAI, and Brian Caulfield, Professor in Transportation at Trinity College Dublin. We're going to delve deep into the data surrounding our transportation habits. We're going to unpack the design elements of infrastructure we have in our still very car-centric society and explore some solutions that will propel us toward a more sustainable, public and zero carbon transportation system. Fergus and Brian, you're both very welcome to this episode of 180 Degrees.
Thank you for having us.
Now, let's start out with, I suppose, the umbrella view of the challenge that Ireland faces. We are and remain a car-centric society. Is that a fair comment?
Yes, I would say definitely a very fair comment. And where we're starting off from is not a very good space whatsoever. We're heavily reliant on our cars. Our emissions profiles last year went up by 6% in transport, and they need to go down by 50% by the end of the decade. So compared to other sectors, it's a very difficult job to get done by 2030.
Are both of you of the view that this is as much a psychological shift as it is a practical one? You know, in the same way that, for instance, Irish people are housing dependent, they like their three-bedroom semi with the front and back garden, and pushing them into apartments has been a job of work. Are we like that with cars? We're two-car families. We like them outside our door. We don't trust public transport to get us from A to B at the time we need to be there. Or is that too simplistic?
It's not too simplistic. I wouldn't say it's a psychological thing. I think it's a societal thing. We are car dependent by design, and by that we have designed our built environment to rely on cars, and we have underinvested for decades in public transport and therefore compounded that reliance on cars. And that makes it really, really difficult, as Brian said, to reduce emissions. So what it requires is, I suppose, a multi-decade focus on changing the way we have designed our urban environments, the way we've designed our rural environments. That cannot happen by a technology shift. That has to happen by a societal shift. And that societal shift will take a number of decades.
Mm. Brian, how much of it is carrot and how much is the necessary stick?
I think it's going to have to be both. I think if we want to hit the target for 2030, we're going to need massive carrots and huge sticks. I think that's almost one of the problems we have of is this 2030 target that's looming over us that no other country in the world has ever been able to achieve. But so in terms of the carrots by 2030, the best we could probably hope for in public transport is Bus Connects finished, maybe the Lewis line extension to Finglas. But after that, you're talking about into the 2030s before any of the metros or any of the other light rail extensions in Dublin or Cork are done. But then if that doesn't happen and we don't get the modal shift, that's when the stick has to come out. And that's the kind of sticks that we've seen in other cities, congestion charging, low emission zones, those types of things.
Now, I can almost hear people listening groaning at the thought when you say Lewis line extensions and bus infrastructures, you know, they're thinking of planning. They're thinking of objections. They're thinking of dug up roads all over the place and the decades that it seems to be before we can do something in Ireland compared to a city like Amsterdam or a country like Denmark that just seems to not quite railroad these things in, no pun intended, but certainly get things done a little bit more efficiently. Are we looking at a much slower shift than we really need? Brian?
We definitely need to be moving quicker. I had the third year students there back in September. One of the students came up to me at the end of the class after I showed him all these kind of plans we have for Dublin. He said, do you not get terribly frustrated, Brian? And I do get terribly frustrated. Yeah, we're not moving anywhere near quick enough. The Lewis extension to Finglas will probably take about a decade, and that's 4 kilometres of light rail track. We're not in the space anymore that we can afford to take that much time to deliver public transport infrastructure. We need good planning. We need all of the due diligences around that, but we need to move a lot quicker. I've said before that I think we need to have, you know, a cross-party policy on transport, almost like a sláinte care for transport, because if government were to change and somebody wanted to make an alteration, let's say, to Metro, that could set us back 4 or 5 years. We don't have that time anymore.
Fergus, how do you do that in an environment where we have outsourced all of our planning outside government? It's very difficult for decisions to be made that don't involve all these external processes that are there for very, very good reasons and people taking legal challenges to which they are entitled. And that seems to act as a stumbling block.
Yeah, well, it's to have the right type of planning system for our needs. And as Brian said, we got to act as if we're in an emergency, because we are in an emergency. So when you're planning this type of infrastructure, and this goes for public transport, but it also goes for renewable electricity infrastructure and other elements we're going to need for the transition, we're doing it in an accelerated pace. And that requires people, it requires skills, the right skills in the right place, and the right systems and processes where, yes, we have a democratic system where people can engage with that system, but not frustrated, I guess, for years and years, or, you know, disproportionately frustrated where these projects are a benefit to society.
Mm. Now, I was reading some notes about car dependency and where we fit, and I was actually shocked to learn that we've the second highest car dependency in the EU. 76% of people use their car daily versus 45% in Europe. What are they doing differently, Brian?
Well, I suppose the thing about it, to go back to the situation we're currently in, like, we've kind of baked in this car dependency because of all of the road infrastructure that we've built and the lack of any investment for decades in public transport. That's changing now, and things like Connecting Ireland are moving quickly. But that's the reason. It's the most efficient mode. It's the most reliable mode. And that's why people use it so often. And in the past decade, one of the things we look at when we look at a country or a city for transport is the mode share. How many people are taking each? What percentage? A decade ago, it was 70% of people drove. Last year, it was 69%. So in a decade, we dropped by 1%. Gosh. That's the scary thing. And how we turn that around and how we accelerate that to the 20-30% reduction we need to see in that as per the Climate Action Plan is going to be really difficult. And that's why I think, you know, sticks may have to come out sooner rather than later.
When people are interviewed and asked why they are not using public transport or cycle lanes or walking or whatever, what kind of reasons do they come up with that are most common? Is it about the weather? Is it about it doesn't get me from door to door exactly? Is it because, oh, I have to bring all the kids with me? How do people answer that, Brian?
It's everything. It's everything you just said. Everybody, there's always many different reasons, and some of them really good reasons, why they don't use public transport, because it's not reliable. They've got other commitments with children or family members that they need, or they need it for accessibility reasons. So there's many reasons why people say that they don't use public transport.
Are they right?
In some parts of the country, definitely. Definitely in rural parts of Ireland, you know, one bus service every two or three times a day, that's not reliable enough for somebody to depend upon. So in some cases, they're right. But I think in the cities, especially in Dublin and Cork, our public transport offering has gotten a lot better. There are really good plans there in place to make it even better than it currently is. Because let's face it, in some of the cities, it couldn't get worse. But even when we saw the free public transport argument, one of the pieces of modelling that was done by the NTA at the time was that people don't want free public transport. They just want it better. They want it more frequent and they want it better.
But there are good news stories locally, Fergus, aren't there? I mean, places like Athlone and other cities where, or other towns where they have, really improved public transport and these local link buses, for instance. Tell us a little bit about where it is being done well.
Yeah, so there, I think Brian touched on it there. We've definitely rebalanced the investment that's being made. So investment is critical here, and sustained investment for decades is critical when it comes to public transport. These are large projects and so on. But definitely, yeah, rural public transport is in the main, you know, buses. And obviously those buses bringing you onto what we would know as the intercity lines in terms of rail and getting you to the main urban centres. That's the structure of rural public transport. And there are success stories there. I mean, I believe the figures that have recently come out is we've gone from 10,000 journeys a week to 70,000, a sevenfold increase from 2018 on local link services in recent years. That's an incredible step forward. It's a huge amount more to do. But I think what's happened there is there's been investment. Those services are more regular. They're reliable. They worked with the communities to realign routes that make, you know, you would have bus companies defining routes. Now you have communities defining the routes. I was down in Dingle with the Dingle Hub in July, and their story is incredible. You know, they totally changed. They worked with the local transport companies and changed the routes of the transport operators. They've totally electrified the buses down on the Dingle Peninsula. I think they're just coming into operation, and they've seen enormous increases. Just locally, they went from about 5,000 users in 2020, and they're going for something like 40,000 users in 2023, or 40,000 journeys. So you can see just the exponential opportunities there. So like Brian said, if it's reliable, if it's effective, if it's routine, people will adapt and they will use public transport. And I think there will be naysayers that say it won't work in rural Ireland, but it can. And it could be part of the transport mix and turn the dial on that car dependency.
So, Brian, there is a kind of a sense of build it and they will come about it, because we saw during the COVID lockdown, a lot of the councils took the opportunity to do cycle lanes where they would have had to close roads for months and months and months, and suddenly the roads were empty, so they were able to get it underway. Is it initiatives like that that we need to kind of not quite bulldoze through, because I think that probably won't be tolerated, but, you know, involve the community in it so they have an ownership of what's to come?
Massively so. And I don't think we've ever regretted any investment in public transport in this country. I can't really think of many public transport lines that we would take up or we would change. But yes, definitely. We saw that with Bus Connects in Dublin. The NTA got into the communities. They listened to the communities. It was round after round of consultation. Now they've got the right plan. The plan is whipped on board Planola. And it will be there for as long as it's whipped on board Planola for. But engaging with communities is vital. This is a transformational change we have to have in this country. And it's not just in transport, it's in energy and all the other sectors. We can't do transformational change without listening and without talking to people. And that's even more so in terms of public transport. We need to bring people with us. You also need good data, and we need good research that, you know, if there are people complaining about a cycle lane and they're worried about noise or they're worried about air quality, we go out and measure it and we'll see what the impacts are. Measure and model the traffic. Not be afraid to pilot things. Not be afraid to fail. Fail, learn more, and then do it again.
Feel better, yeah. And I'm old enough to remember the objections to the DART when it came up a million years ago, and people were saying it was going to ruin the landscape. Nobody would use it. Why would you get on the train when you can drive? And in truth, of course, it has been and remains a phenomenal success, more than the Lewis. People said you didn't need to join up the lines. There you go. We joined up the lines and we're extending it. So there is an element, though, at some point, the authority has to say, trust us, all will be well. And that's a difficult kind of leap in some cases.
It can be, yes. And there are some cities around the world that have done things like that. Trust us and it'll go well. Like the congestion charge in London and in Stockholm. In Stockholm, they had a vote. They asked everybody that they wanted. They said, yeah, let's trial it. And they trialed it. It worked. And it's still there. And it's working very well. One of the things, if it could click my fingers in the morning, wouldn't be to have the metro running out to the airport, because we're only likely to ever have one of those lines. It would be one of the Bus Connects lines. Click my fingers, one of those is in place. Everyone will see how quick it gets people around the city, how it will transform how we look at buses in the city. That would be one of the things that I think if we could do it and people could see it, they wouldn't be objecting.
Okay. Well, look, when it comes then to sharing the road space and trying to compete with all of these different interests. I suppose for the motorist, and I presume this is deliberate, they feel ever more squeezed into that one lane, and they see buses and cyclists and now the soon-to-be legal scooters coming up and down beside them. And while we are trying to move people on, there's also this push towards electric vehicles. We spoke about it in episode 3. So are we trying to do too much of the time, do you think? Fergus, what do you think?
I mean, the nature of our sort of carbon journey that we're on at the moment is, I suppose, the amount that has to be done in such a short period is a symptom of not doing enough for a long period. So unfortunately, we have targets and objectives to do these things. We have an ambition to do these things. And that is going to require significant change in a short period of time. And we're going to have to, as a society, square away some of these. They're often presented as arguments, but you talk about there's no such thing as a motorist. That's a very bizarre construct. The same as there's no such thing as a cyclist. What you're talking about are citizens that are living in an urban and rural environment and how to use the infrastructure that we all pay for. Again, there's this construct that some people pay more, some people less. Most cyclists are motorists. A lot of motorists are cyclists. And everybody's a pedestrian at some point in their life and has to use the pedestrian infrastructure. So I just think we need a vision, and there is a vision in Climate Action Plan when you look at it, but people need to buy into that vision, and they need to understand that, you know, it will improve our cities, our towns, our rural environments. And at a very basic level, I would ask people to think about school kids, because I think it's very easy for us to get it in our heads. I think anybody of a certain age probably cycled school, and yet that has collapsed. In only 20 years in Ireland, the amount of kids cycling to school has collapsed. And that is because parents are afraid to put them on the road. And they're afraid to put them on the road because they see the behavior of people in their cars and they see it as a danger. If that doesn't strike an emotional chord with people about how we've...
But isn't it ironic then, because they take the same kids and put them in their own car and then add to...
Correct. So, yeah, people complaining about traffic are normally traffic themselves would be a firm thing. But yeah, so
you'd like to see more schools maybe doing things like... walking buses or having school bus like they have in the States. You know, everybody gets on a school bus.
And it is being expanded a huge amount. But no, the cycle buses are a really good initiative, but actually they shine a light on the problem. They are not the solution. The solution is integrated active travel infrastructure for kids to get to school. They should be able to get on the bike at their home or near their home and cycle in a very safe manner, segregated from the motor end of the travel infrastructure, right to their school gate. And that's the type of urban and rural communities we actually can create if there's a vision and if people buy into it as the right thing to do. And when you see kids cycling to school in the morning, I live in a relatively suburban area and they cycle on the footpath. It's quite sad, actually. They cycle on the footpath and they have to go up in the grass verge to go around normal pedestrians. And they do it in a housing estate because the driving behaviour in the housing estate is so poor that their parents have told them, don't go on the road. Quite sad that we're in this state.
Indeed. And when you visit cities, Brian, where, you know, the cycling infrastructure has been put front and centre. In other words, the motorist gets short shrift on the roads and they're dealt with all kinds of obstacles. And I'm thinking primarily of a city I know very well, which is Amsterdam. And I know they're always held up to be the beacon of, you know, people say, well, it's flat there and it's easy to do and everybody's bought into the culture. But it wasn't always like that. You look back at photographs and video from the 1970s and it looks like O'Connell Street on a busy day.
Yep. And what they did in Amsterdam and cities like that, say Copenhagen as well, that they realised that it was a generational thing. And they brought the kids to school with bikes and they educated them about active travel and how to do it safely. Those kids now, maybe they didn't cycle, but now they're people that are cycling or that they're drivers and their behaviour is better because of it. It does take, it's a generational thing that has to happen, because changing our how we move and where we move is really difficult. So it is something that is going to take time. It's not a click our fingers and we're going to get to Copenhagen levels of cycling. That's just not possible, no matter what we do.
I'm curious, because sometimes external events can overtake us when we're, you know, trying to make plans. COVID was one of them, and things can happen. So you're talking about a generational thing there, but I'm wondering, are we already along that line? Because, for instance, younger people are far less inclined to want to do what certainly I did, maybe you did, which is get your license at 18, buy a car, get on the road and get out there. There's an awful lot of them saying, I don't need to do that, especially if they're in cities and they're working from home. They're only in offices a couple of days a week. And they're like, I don't want the expense of the car. I don't want to, I have nowhere to put it.
Exactly. And also because of the sharing economy that they've grown up in with Airbnb and Netflix, all these types of things. They realise a car spends 95% of its time parked. And it's a very, after if you're lucky enough to buy a home, it's the second most expensive asset you're likely to own. And then it's only working 5% of the time for you. And even if it's an electric car, it's still only working 5% of the time for climate. They're more shrewd, I suppose, to see it as a wasteful asset. But then equally, you know, we give big grants for electric vehicles and they only really decarbonize 5% of the time. If wind turbines were only blowing 5% of the time, we'd soon stop building those. So it's a more kind of, I suppose, we'll always need cars in our cities and towns. We'll always need some sort of car. Hopefully they would be electric. But I think we need to start to look at our relationship with it. And I think, you know, the sharing model of cars is something that you do see in cities like Amsterdam, and it does work quite well.
And of course, we have those here too, Fergus. We have go cars and other sharing options that people have taken on board. And do you think that market could increase, certainly with the younger age group who can drive but don't own a car?
Yeah, so there's two elements to this. There's that kind of shared ownership model, car clubs, pay-as-you-go type services for cars. And the next thing is autonomous vehicles, which aren't really prevalent in Ireland. But in the States and in Asia, you can get picked up at the airport by a taxi with nobody in it.
Now
we're getting scared, are we? So as Brian said, the number one benefit of owning a car is it's in your driveway when you need it. There are other ways to achieve that, which mean we don't all have to own cars. And that will freak some people out because they want to keep their stuff in it or whatever it might be. But the reality is, if you can come up with a way where there is a car in your driveway or nearby when you need it, and all of that technology is available today, then car ownership becomes very, very questionable. Certainly owning a second car becomes extremely questionable.
Now, without getting into an episode of Black Mirror, can you see a future, and when would it be, where you would have maybe driving hubs in a village where people go, take the car, bring it back, you know, the same way they do with the shared bike scheme now. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you can see in the not too distant future, Brian?
I definitely can see it
it's
happening now. SEAI are funding us in Trinity to do it. So there's a partnership between SEAI, the Atlantic Technical University, Trinity, ESB, and Enterprise. And we're putting in hubs at the moment. We're looking at locations in Letterkenny. We're looking at locations in Sligo and Galway to put in shared electric cars, shared electric bikes, and shared e-cargo bikes, so that people can become members and then they can use them. I think it's going to be interesting, especially in a rural context outside of Dublin, to see, do these things work? And if they're not working, is it the price point? What is it that we can do to make these things work? Because I do think they can work, and they've been proven to work in many rural parts of and other parts of the world quite effectively.
So you want, I suppose, to bring people along to the notion that you've all the benefits of using a car without the hassle and the cost of owning one.
Exactly. And it won't work for everybody. It'll be some certain people that this won't work for. But if we can make it work for 10-20% of people, that's an extra however many kilometres we get off at a petrol and diesel. The other thing I think is great about them as well is that it's a little showroom for an electric car. If somebody hasn't driven one before, they can get to try it and they get to see what it's like, and no more than when you get into an electric taxi. So that's the kind of model that we're looking at in this pilot project. And it is a pilot, and we really hope it's successful. I know our commercial partners are very determined to make it successful. But in Trinity, we're going to do the research. We're going to see, you know, if it's not successful, why isn't it successful? Why is it better in one town than another? Is it near a train station that it's better? Or is it better in a public park? Those types of things.
Okay, so there's lots to come on that. So we'll wait that data with some interest if that works. Fergus, can I bring it out then maybe to a wider issue? Because that's about getting to work and dropping the kids off and getting around a community. There's a wider conversation to be had about leisure trips or business trips, specifically off this island. And we are an island, you know, it's not easy to get off it. And most people immediately will think of plane journeys to do that. And that's something, you know, that largely we're trying to cut down on, despite all the green fleets and, you know, we hear about cleaner airplanes, they're still airplanes. You are a fan of the so-called rail and sail model. Talk to us about what that is and how it works.
I'm a big fan of it. And if anybody has ever considered doing it, I'd really strongly urge people to do it. So we have a very good sail rail connection to the UK and to London particularly. It takes, this will shock people, it takes about 9 hours from my house to central London. So it takes about 9 hours. But during that 9 hours, you have 4 hours on an extremely comfortable ferry where you can work. And you have 3.5 hours on an extremely comfortable train where you can work. So you can effectively get a day's work traveling to London done. I can't describe how I really like the ferry. It reminds me of going. We went to France a lot when I was a kid with my mom and dad, and I take my kids now, and I really do like the ferry, and I love trains as well. So, but it's extremely pleasant. I haven't actually had an opportunity to go further because another 2.5 hours on from there, you can get to Paris or Brussels. And I'm normally in Paris or Brussels every couple of years at work, but I just haven't had it at the moment. So if you compare that to the alternative, which is you leave your house, you try and get to the airport maybe 90 minutes before your flight, you have to strip down
four
and
miles
take
away.
Your belt off and your watch and you go through. And it's just a flying. Unfortunately, flying isn't a very pleasant experience. I don't care what anybody says. You cannot work. You might catch 40 minutes in the airport, maybe with a coffee to do some emails, but it's very hard to work on a flight, particularly an economy flight. I've never flown anything but economy in my life. So you have to look, it's probably 5 hours door to door for London for most people when you consider all of this. Yes, you're only on the flight for less than an hour, but all of the other bits getting into London. So you have to compare it really on its merits and realize that it's not that bad and it's very, very pleasant. And I arrived into London relaxed and refreshed with a full day of work done, where otherwise I would have probably got in at 10 o'clock at night. The flight might have been delayed and then you're getting to the hotel at 1 or 2 in the morning. Like, these are the things that really happen when we think it's convenient. It's not that convenient. So I would really look at it. I have a blog somewhere on the SAI website if people want to see how it's done. It could be better integrated is the one thing I'd say. And I think there's now Sail Rail to France, believe it or not, which you can buy your combined ferry and rail ticket to Paris from Dublin.
Yeah, so people are kind of used to doing it on the leisure side where they have a couple of weeks off or a couple of weeks holidays and building in how to get there with their own, with no weight restrictions and fitting everything into tiny bags and all that. So people already for many years have known the benefit of that. So you'd like to see people broadening that out into the short haul, the short trips, the business trips and seeing that as a viable option.
Well, it is a viable option. I think it could be better integrated, but yeah, I think there's a real opportunity there. And if anybody's really, if you go to London on the regular, I would just ask that one direction, give it a try. It's a lot better integrated than you would think. I can recommend a really good cafe in Holyhead for the 45 minute wait. Really, really good, guys. Have nice coffee. So trust me on this. It's a very pleasant journey to do. And well worth it. And you will not lose the time you think. In fact, you'll gain time that you would otherwise have lost.
Brian, do you see a role for the EU Parliament in making a travel? I mean, we know there are trans-European rail lines and sleeper trains and it's all very romantic and all of that. But do you think there is more that could be done at a policy level to really push that agenda and kind of really reduce our carbon footprint in terms of air miles?
Yeah, I think we could. And as Fergus said, you know, it just needs to be a bit tighter in terms of the turnaround times and to have it as a viable alternative. But I suppose from a work perspective, I would travel to the UK quite a bit with mainly examining PhD students, that type of thing. More often than not, that's now done online. And we do a Teams call. It's not as good for the candidate, but or maybe it's better for the candidate. They're less stressed. But yeah, I think that Parliament could do it. I think the national government could do it as well. And also companies could do it too, to give more incentives to employees to forgo these short haul flights. Or if you're doing a long haul flight, that you pack in a number of different activities while you're doing a long haul flight. So I do those as well. I'm doing a flight to Washington, D.C. in January. I'm presenting at a conference there. I sit on a number of research boards over there too. There's also a very big transport conference coming to Dublin next year, the Transport Research Arena. So we're meeting with the US counterparts over there at the embassy. So we're trying to pack in as much as possible. But I think that's quite important to try and be able to do something like that. But I think that it is down to the companies. It is down to government. It's around those policies of, you know, not allowing the overnight over and back to Brussels. And the Commission has gotten better on that, I'd say, in EU projects that I'm involved in. They've cut the travel by half because every second meeting is online and the Commission meet us online as well. So that's better. But, you know, we could be a lot better and they could be a lot better, I suppose, in the types of policies they put out there.
Fergus, you were talking a little bit about the local link, the bus shuttle services that take place. And it seems to me like a fantastic idea for those short hops that just go forward and back and forward and back, you know, to places where people actually want to go. Do you think there could be more, and I know it's ferociously expensive, on the rail network side, I mean, there was a time, like 100 years ago, we had rail lines all over this country. Is there an argument and is there a will, do you think, to extend the rail network to do just that? We are currently subsidising a lot of those short routes, I know, particularly in the west of Ireland. And people in the northwest particularly will say, we've no train at all. We'll take anything.
Yeah, so I mean, look, there's an All-Ireland Rail strategy just published a couple of months ago. And that looks at a significant electrification of the rail. It looks at a significant expansion of the existing networks, adding, you know, where the single track, making it dual track, which is vital. And as anybody who's on a single track line could tell you, you get delayed as soon as any train is delayed. And then also expansion of the network. So there is a plan to actually finally reconnect Donegal to the rail network. That's a plan in place. As we talked about at the start, this requires multi-decade levels of investment and a consistency to not scrap these projects, to prioritise road projects, not scrap them to prioritise other investments. So it is a big national investment. It's actually a cross-border investment because obviously our rail network is integrated with Northern Ireland, and that will give more opportunities. That will give more what we would consider regional rail opportunities. I think at the moment what's really interesting is the suburban rail networks around Cork and Limerick are being invested in.
They're going to get a Lewis, are they? Or an equivalent?
Cork has a Lewis planned, and I think Galway has a very early stage plan for... Very early, but Cork is quite advanced. They're trying to effectively secure the investment and so on. So yeah, light rail. I mean, Galway's an ideal city for light rail, really. So all of these things take time.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge, right? So what do we do in the meantime to get people out of cars, to get people using the opportunities that are the available public transport more and the available active transport more? And that is making it more reliable. That is making it and people seeing that there's an alternative, because that's what a lot of the problem is in the moment. Is people are sitting maybe in their car listening to this and they're saying, yes, I'd love to, but I have no alternative. Yeah. You have to give the alternatives.
So, Brian, in terms of, like, it's one thing kind of saying we have a rail strategy and it'll be great to link up all these places again. But in fact, the roads are already there. And maybe the future then is in more frequent and better car sharing and bus operatives. Should we just ditch the rail altogether?
No, I don't think we should ditch the rail altogether. We're fantastic in this country at writing reports and transport. It's the delivery that's often lacking. Yes, in the interim, the bus is going to be the biggest option that we have, because it will take decades, as we said, for the rail infrastructure to get up to par, get it, the line secured and safe. And even small rail projects that are reinstatement of rail, like, say, the Navan rail line, that's one that is crying out to be done and has been crying out to be done for decades. So small projects like that, I think we could start to expedite quicker and act like we're in an emergency. Then when it comes to roads, yes, we've loads of roads. And the leader of government did say when this rail report was dropped that, you know, it was a perfect opportunity to invest in more roads. I would tend to disagree on that. But the roads carry our freight. They carry the vast majority of our freight, and our freight is one of the sectors within transport that the emissions profile is increasing. So we do need good and safe roads, and we've seen this year more than any other year how safe we need our roads to be. We can start to look at alternative fuels for trucks that are delivering freight. I'm not sure the battery technology will get us where we need to be, but maybe hydrogen, maybe pushing more into rail freight. And that's what the rail review really looked at. It was to push it onto that. But in the interim, it will be buses. Connecting Ireland is fantastic. The fully electric bus fleet in Athlone is amazing. I'm going there tomorrow. I can't wait to see it. So there are lots of really good things that are happening right across the country. It's the speed at which they're happening.
Of course, the urban planning has quite a lot that we can fit in here. And I'm thinking in particular when it came to the rollout of the National Broadband Plan, one of the things that was noted there was that if we can have more people living near urban centres and not this ribbon one-off housing development, which has blighted our country for very, very many years, or allowed people to live near their family farms, whichever way you look at it. Is the same argument true? I mean, if we can have higher density living in villages and towns and communities rather than in one-off rural places, the bus nearly looks after itself then, the routes, don't they?
Exactly, yes. And Ireland's population density is half the EU average. And that's one of our biggest problems. Around the same population as that live in the Greater Dublin area live in rural Ireland, and how you connect those people to services, electricity, transport, all of these different things is a big problem. Also, then when it comes to heating and energy, and you know, things like district heating become much more viable when we get into smaller, more densely populated communities. Better public transport comes with more densely populated areas. And you see that in London and all the other cities.
And of course, any developer out there worth their salt knows that a house will sell for more, an apartment will sell for more if they've good transport links nearby. Isn't that what people look for fundamentally when they want, well, especially when the kids start to arrive and they want to get them to school and they need to get to towns and all that kind of thing?
Look back a decade ago, maybe even longer, if you drove out towards Howth, every property development there had a picture of the metro on it, and they sold lots and lots of apartments to people on that side of the city.
Picking a poke.
Exactly.
Okay, they have to be real. Right, we get it. Now, because we're on this umbrella episode of looking at all the macro transport options, I'm going to ask you both, Fergus, let me start with you. What's on your wish list? Look ahead to 20 years' time. What will Irish public transport look like for you if you had your dream?
If I had my dream, wow. So I think the cities are fairly clear. You know, I think what's in the pipeline, we kind of know what's going to be there in the next 20 years. So we're going to have a metro in Dublin. We're going to have more electrification, which is going to help with emissions. And we're going to have, you know, a much better bus system, which has been well publicized. And we mirrors of that in Cork and Limerick and Galway. And hopefully they need to accelerate it much more. I think that the tricky one is going to be our dispersed population in rural Ireland. I think electric vehicles offer a lot of opportunity there, because the range of electric vehicles now and the fact that most rural dwellers have a way of charging them at their house means that the infrastructure challenge isn't as great. But for me, really, my magic wand would be more active travel in both rural and urban environments. We don't have good quality cycle infrastructure at all. It's improving, but it's really, really sporadic. And I think that offers probably the biggest opportunity to get modal shift in the shorter term.
Okay. Now, Brian, you're often called upon to advise government. It's Citizens Assembly. You spoke to that. If you were advising future governments as one, without the political constraints, what would you be advising them to do over the next couple of decades?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is that we need maybe five more politicians, and that we need directly elected mayors in all of our cities, and that they could take control and they could take ownership of their cities. And that's what we see when we look across Europe or across the world. The cities that do well have directly elected mayors. Somebody with a mandate that has the people behind them, and they can do the cycling infrastructure and all of those kind of things. I think purely from an engineering perspective, the big projects we want to do in Dublin and Cork and the other cities, they have been interfered with for so long. And that's why I suppose that we have these massive delays. I would like to see an infrastructure policy for each of the cities agreed and then pushed forward, and then look at it incrementally and over provide public transport. So in Galway, if we were to put a light rail line like we have here in Dublin and the Lewis, it would probably take everybody in the city to use it on a daily basis to make money. Maybe we stop thinking about making money. Maybe we start thinking about making people's lives better and reducing our emissions. Cork, I think the line will stand up for itself. Then you get into Limerick and Waterford, and then you start to think about what alternatives could be put there. And there's nothing to say that we couldn't look at light rail in those cities as well. So I think expedite this. If we're building, you know, I think I added it up there recently, that we're building over 100 kilometres of light rail. Let's get it all done. Let's get it done at the one time. And then hopefully after 20 years and 10 years time, the city will look like a construction site. And that will be a good thing, because we're making progress. But then in 20 years time, that the cities are back to the way they were, and we have this light rail infrastructure in place. And then bringing a car into the city, even an electric one, will be a second thought to people.
All right. Well, listen, on that note, we will leave it there for the moment. Thank you for joining us today, Fergus Sharkey from the SEAI and Professor Brian Caulfield, Professor of Transportation at Trinity College Dublin. If you've enjoyed this episode, well, then do please listen to our other episodes on 180 Degrees, wherever you get your podcasts from. We cover all kinds of issues from the macro to the micro. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to the 180 Degrees podcast. If you've enjoyed it, why not like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes? Please tell your family and friends. And to find out more information, check out seai.ie.